Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. We hear a lot of conversation about adapting to climate change. What can we learn from some of these efforts that through unintended consequences leads to more harm? Science journalist Stephen Robert Miller takes us to three regions in the world to show how attempts to control nature have backfired. His book is Over the Sea Wall, Tsunamis, Cyclones, Drought, and the Delusion of Controlling Nature. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Mindy. Thanks for having me.
So your book is about unintended consequences, and you write about fixes that do more harm than good and the folly of overconfidence. Academics call it maladaptation. In simple terms, it's about solutions that backfire. So what set you on this journey?
Years of writing about solutions, actually. I have, as an environmental freelance reporter for many years, and previously I worked as an editor for a magazine called Yes, which is based in Seattle, and their focus is solutions journalism. And so I had spent years writing and editing stories with about solutions to some of the world's biggest and most complex problems. And I still have an enormous amount of faith in solutions and agree that we desperately need good solutions. But the key there is the good part, because I think, as the stakes get higher and higher because of the climate change, especially, it's easy for us to kind of rush into making decisions and to glom on to solutions in the hope that something, you know, will save us from the ravages that we're seeing happen, you know, every single season now. And I started over and over recognizing some solutions were causing some of their own problems down the road. And that can be incredibly dangerous. So I started just kind of exploring that this world of what academics call maladaptation.
So you start the book with a trip to Japan, and you look at the impact of the tsunami that hit in 2011 and the response to be better prepared for the next big wave, right? So let's start with the tsunami. Remind people of what happened.
Sure. So this was March 11th, 2011. There was a 9.1 magnitude earthquake that struck off the northeast coast of Japan. And it sent a tsunami barreling toward the coast. That part of Japan and northeast is called Tohoku. That region, some people there put it to me, is kind of being like the American South in a sense, where it's been kind of overlooked in terms of investment for years, a little bit more economically depressed, a slightly older population than the rest of the country. And Japan population is already pretty old, right? And so people there were heavy dependence on fishing, and they were living, you know, mostly in coastal villages, small kind of hamlets in these little notches in the rocks in the coast. And the wave came, it took about a half an hour to 45 minutes, depending on where you were living along the coast. And it rose to 130 feet in some places. The run up height was 130 feet, which is just very difficult to wrap your mind around. And in the end, about 20,000 people died. I think the official number is something around 19,747 official deaths. And there are still something like 2,500 people who are considered missing because their bodies have not been discovered.
Yeah.
It's been, you know, now since 2011.
So tell us a little about the seawalls and that false sense of security they created that led to many of these deaths, right?
Yeah. So it's important to recognize first that when I talk about maladaptation, it's not just that these solutions utterly fail. It's actually that they might be somewhat successful in some ways, but they have unintended consequences, negative unintended consequences that act out on people maybe of a different social status, or just downstream or down the coastline, or down the line in the future, you know, further generations. So the issue with the seawalls there was they're considered to be maladaptive because they offer this false sense of security that kept people from evacuating along the coastline. Part of that had to do with the initial warning said that the wave was only going to be around 9 feet tall. And in some places, people were protected by a wall that was 13 feet already. These existing seawalls were 13 feet tall. And then some of those towns, you know, the wave was 20 or 40 feet high. So it was totally outmatched. But for me, you know, obviously tsunamis are not a climate driven event, but for me, the story of what happened there really summed up this issue of maladaptation in a way that I was able to wrap my mind around it. It was a story in a nutshell. Climate change is this slow creeping, event, whereas a tsunami is very discreet. It's immediate. You can really see what happened in a nutshell there. And so that's why I include it and start the book there, because it's really where I learned about how to understand this issue. So what happened was along some of these coastal towns, where there had been recent investment in new walls and people did not have a history of tsunamis, the death toll was actually highest.
Which is surprising, right? Yeah.
Yes. People thought the walls would protect them from a wave that the walls were not intended to protect them from.
So you're right, Japan has been on the forefront of seismic and tsunami prediction since science since the 1970s. But by all accounts, 2011 caught everybody by surprise. So what happened there? Why was this such a surprise?
Because the wave was just so big.
Was they were expecting it to be that big?
They were not expecting a wave to be that big. There actually had been in years prior, there had been several researchers who raised a warning saying that there was a good chance that this country was due for another massive earthquake event. But they were not really taken seriously. And so when the wave came, people were just completely taken off guard. One of the stories that I find that I discovered in the book as a researcher there who digs through people's personal history, like their receipts and their wedding invitations, their tax records. And sometimes in Japan, because the paper walls, people line their walls with paper, some of these records are actually kept in the walls. And when folks do renovations on their home, they find these old records and they turn them into this researcher, and he uses them to learn about the past. And he had learned from some old sources he had dug up that there had actually likely been a wave in this region only 400 years prior, as opposed to 1,000 years prior. And so his perspective on this, his argument was that the country was way overdue for this wave, and that a 400 year interval was much more common than people realize. And so that really, changes the risk level, right? If it's a 1,000 year event versus a 400 year event, that should change the way we think about where we, invest, we develop homes and industries along the coastline there.
So the idea of higher sea walls can create a situation where you can't see what's coming, like the video of the woman riding the bike behind the seawall, obstructing her view so she can't see the wave that's about to spill over and wash her away. So following the tsunami, are we finding, hey, let's just bigger seawalls?
Yes. In fact, that became the story that I really focus on in the section of the book. Because when I got to Japan and started looking into this, I was finding people who were resistant to the walls, resistant to new walls. So immediately after the wave, of course, people want something to happen. And this is why, I think it's so important with climate change, is we're all seeing these events, close to home here. When something big like this happens, you immediately, yes, of course, you want there to be a solution. You want someone to come in and say, we've got the answer, we're going to protect you. And so, right after the wave in 2011, government swooped in with experts to each of these towns that had been, in some cases, just destroyed, and said, hey, we've got the solution. We are going to build bigger, taller walls to protect you from the sea. And at first, folks in these communities were, sure, please do something. But as time went on, these are fishing villages where people depend on their relationship with the ocean, their view of the sea for protection, just their culture, their tourist towns. And people wonder, why would anybody come all the way up here on the Shinkansen just to look at, concrete? And so they started pushing back against the walls. And it became the story of local people trying to having to fight this, monolithic government. Just about what is the best for, what's in their own best interests.
Sotogai was a phrase you heard a lot, meaning beyond imagination. And you write that it immediately caught your ear because it reminded you of another term that you've been hearing lately, the no analog future. So talk a little bit about that.
That's right. The no analog future is right, is this idea and accurate one that what we're heading into with climate change is something that we can't predict. We don't have a baseline for. We don't have any analogs in the past to tell us what's coming. And although I agree with that most of the time, the truth, and I found, that's the reason I wrote this book, is because we do have analogs in the past for our past decisions on how we protect ourselves from natural disasters. We do have baselines of understanding of how certain decisions play out down the road when we start building infrastructure, especially concrete infrastructure, to protect ourselves from whether it's wildfire or storm surges or tsunami or something. And so that's the reason I write the book, really, right? Is I want us to look at at our past, our history with these decisions, and see how they've played out, so we can apply those lessons to the future.
And it's interesting to look at you talk about, I mean, I didn't realize Japan was such a big producer of concrete, but so you're talking about these seawalls. But then you also have this section where you talk about the Great Forest Wall, which was really fascinating. Tell us a little bit about that.
Great Forest Wall, yeah, is a wall built. I forget now the number of kilometers up and down the coast it is, but essentially, it's a whole bunch of trees planted closely together in an attempt to help create a natural buffer, right? So we talk a lot about the seawalls in Japan, but the truth is the country is doing more than just building walls. They're elevating towns, they're pulling towns back, and they're building and they're planting these forests that are like strips of trees that are intended to, surprisingly, not always, you know, not stop a wave, certainly not stop a wave, and not even really slow the wave. In many cases, what these forests are designed to do is keep things and people from washing back out to the ocean when a wave comes in.
You write, how do we ensure that our adaptations travel through time with their meanings intact? How do we avoid the sense of urgency we build them with from fading into complacency over centuries to come? That's a good question.
Thanks. Yeah. And that comes back to that researcher who was looking at, you know, this wave coming on a 400-year cycle instead of a 1,000-year cycle. And there had been, you know, 400 years ago, proof of this wave, but it had been kind of overlooked. And 400 years previously, people in Japan had made efforts to change the way they lived in reaction to a big wave, but their decisions had been kind of, you know, ignored or just kind of forgotten over time. And so I was standing in this place along the coastline where there were all these hills that had been raised up. And these hills are evacuation hills. They look kind of like, I don't know, like Aztec temples or something, but they were earthen, you know, and they were actually piles of debris that had been covered over by grass. And the idea was that they would provide places for people to flee in case of an event. But looking around in these areas, there were no homes there. There was only a few businesses like factories and things and a couple farms, but not a lot of people there. And so it really made me wonder, like, who are these mounds, you know, erected for? Who's going to flee up these things in the event of a tsunami? And then I thought, started wondering, you know, and how are future generations 400 years down the road going to look at these mounds? Are they going to know that that's what they were built for? Or are they just going to think there was some fun, you know, topographic feature and start building homes at the bottom of them right along the coast again?
We're talking with science journalist Stephen Robert Miller about his book, Over the Seawall, Tsunami, Cyclones, Drought, and the Delusion of Controlling Nature. We'll talk more after a break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking with science journalist Stephen Robert Miller about his book, Over the Seawall, Tsunami, Cyclones, Drought, and the Delusion of Controlling Nature. So next portion of your book is southwest Bangladesh. You start in a village 60 miles north of the Bay of Bengal. Floods are common in this region. So sort of give us an overview of the region.
So the first thing to keep in mind with Bangladesh is that it is a mud plain. It is, I mean, basically compare this to the Mississippi Delta, right, in the U.S. Very similar dynamics happening here. But, you know, Bangladesh is about the size of Iowa in terms of geography, but this is 170 million people living there. And almost the entire country, not all of them, almost the entire country is a deltaic fan of mud that's about 12 kilometers down. You got to go 12 kilometers before you hit any kind of rock. It's just mud. It's been built up over eons of, you know, pieces of the Himalayan mountains and this broad valley collecting down there. And of course, it's in an area that's prone to storm surges from cyclones in the Bay of Bengal and monsoon floods from upland. And so you've got 170 million people living on a postage stamp sized country that's shifting mud, and they're surrounded by water. And something like, depending on who you talk to, anywhere from 230 to about 900 rivers that lace this mud plain.
Yeah.
So it's a very dynamic environment.
Yeah. So in the 1980s, there was an aggressive campaign to promote shrimp agriculture. But of course, that would be at the expense of rice farming. And you tell the story of you know, one woman in particular who tried to stand up. Tell us what was going on with that. The you know, they're trying to come in and make this better for shrimp farming, which, you know, bringing the salt water in is not so great for the rice farming.
That's right. And so this is an example of a solution with unintended consequences. The issue here was that salinity was creeping up into these farms in the rice paddy, which is what most people grow there. And specifically, I'm talking about the southwest portion of Bangladesh, which has a pretty unique hydrology compared to even other parts of that country. And so, you know, rice won't grow well in salt water, brackish water, but shrimp will. And so the idea was, well, we'll just bring in shrimp farms. And that'll give these people here something that continue to grow. What ended up happening was that the shrimp industry, which is really export dependent, was co-opted by, some people call it there, like the shrimp mafia. And these are just wealthy elites, landowners, people who have money, who are able to buy up this rice farmland and turn it into shrimp production places. But the problem was, you put in a shrimp farm, pond, these shrimp ponds, and they taint the underground water sources that people there depend on for drinking. There's been numerous effects linked to, especially negative health effects for women, because women tend to do a lot of the dirty work in cleaning these ponds out. But you know, the first couple of years of having these shrimp ponds in place, they made oodles of money, and mostly selling shrimp to Western buyers. But then over a period of time, only a few years really, the shrimp population started to die off. Diseases started to break out in some of these shrimp ponds. And then of course the water is being tainted, and people who used to depend on their rice agriculture are being pushed out to make room for more shrimp ponds. And so these wealthy landowners, these elites, are going around and pushing rice farmers off their land in order to make up, to create more space for shrimp farming for their own benefit. And so it became this real cultural, you know, flashpoint.
Yeah. And you tell the story of this one woman in particular who tried to stand up to, you know, as these so-called shrimp mafia guys are coming in that want to blow holes in the mud to bring in the salt water. She stands up against them.
Yeah, Karuna Mori Soidar. Yes, she was kind of like a local, you know, community leader. And they had been, you know, her family had been asked and then pressured to leave their land for many years, and had always said they did not want to do that. They wanted to stay where they were living, and they wanted to continue to farm. One day a group of men came, strong men armed with guns and kind of homemade bombs, came to push her and her whole village out so they could make room for more shrimp farming. And she stood up to them, and she was killed. Her body was dragged away and never seen again. Many other people were injured. This did go to the courts there, but nothing really came of that. The people who were accused of things ended up getting let off that down the road. And it's kind of a classic story of, you know, solutions that backfire, the problems with the embankments that are built all along this region, and the conflicts between the haves and the have-nots in the part of the world where people are super vulnerable.
And you write that Bangladesh is notoriously vulnerable to the effects of climate change, which you say much of the blame can be attributed to the unintended consequence of past adaptation. So tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so this is kind of mind-blowing to me. I mean, the common narrative in Bangladesh is not totally untrue, but the common narrative, right, is that it's a deltaic region that's suffering from fast sea level rise due to the climate change. And researchers have found that actually human impacts have caused the land to be sinking at about a rate that matches the rate that the water is rising on the coast. And that is because of the embankments. So just like in the American Louisiana Delta, right, these embankments have been built all up along these rivers to keep the rivers from shifting, to keep them from flooding, from spilling their banks. And you got to remember, right, it said 12 kilometers of mud in Bangladesh. This land was built by mud flowing out of these rivers. Every time these rivers flood, they deposit their sediment across the plain and actually build the land up. Well, what happened when you put the embankments in? These are levees built along the riversides, right? They don't let the rivers flood anymore. And so all that sediment that's washing off the Himalayan mountains and up by India and everything, that sediment is just building up in the rivers rather than spilling across the plain. And so what's happening is the riverbed is rising, the water table in the rivers is rising, but the land outside the rivers where people live and grow on is actually sinking because the mud is compacting. And so what researchers have discovered is that the land outside is sinking at about the same rate or close to the same rate that the water is rising. And so if you didn't have the embankments in place, they think that it's possible that the land would actually naturally keep up with the rate of sea level rise in some places along the coast.
Yeah. Jim, and you talk about levees and corruption, and you write, government officials and representatives of some international aid organizations often place the blame squarely on climate change, saying that sea level rise and cyclones have outmatched their walls. This is only part of the story. The rest lies with the phrase dying river.
Yes, the dying rivers. And I don't know if we have enough time to go into all the hydrology, but I urge people to buy the book and read. Over the Seawall goes into some deep details on the hydrology of this particular part of Bangladesh that explains why these rivers are dying, because they're not actually connected to an upstream source anymore. And so they're purely tidally driven, and they collect, they breathe with the tides from the Bay of Bengal. It's a fascinating hydrological system that's happening there.
Yeah. You talk about the supercyclone, Amphan, is that how you say it, in May of 2020. This sound like, I mean, when you think about the amount of mud and water there, winds 170 miles an hour, waves cresting at 16 feet. It's hard to picture. It's like something out of a movie set.
Yeah, absolutely. And people along here, I think, have some, people living, I mean, along here, I mean, like, in Florida and along the Gulf Coast have are beginning to see this now in ways that they didn't see it in the past, right? This is something that we kind of looked at as other parts of the world had to deal with these problems. Well, they're coming home to America now, in pretty real terms.
Yeah. And you talk about one family's experience through this. And tell us a little bit about that. They're all gathering in their little hut, which there's
That's
water
right.
everywhere.
That's right. There's water everywhere. I mean, it's on the ground, it's in the sky, it's in the air between the ground and the sky and the ocean. The rivers are rising. The bay is essentially encroaching, and they're all huddling in a thatch roofed hut that they live in. The boy who told me this story was walking home from school when I met up with him. And he described clinging to the bed. Oftentimes, families share a bed, and it's an elevated platform within the house. The houses there are often, in this part of the country, are often, mud floored, dirt floored, and they're raised a little bit, but not by much. And so the safest place to be is on the raised platform of the bed, which really is just kind of like a plywood bed with a sheet over it, in many places. And so he was clinging to this with his family, listening to the wind just rattle, the palm fronds on the roof and tear the place apart, and listening to the war. He said it's like a million bees flying through the air as this cyclone battered the coast of Bengal.
Yeah. And then you come out and you see who has survived and who has not in a storm like that.
That's right. And you look around and you see the trees that are there that are not there anymore. You see your neighbors' homes that are no longer there. And you basically emerge from your home into a completely different landscape than the one you saw when you went in.
Yeah. You mentioned that this boy was on his way home from school and shared a story. Did you find that folks were will, you know, more than willing to share their stories of things like this when you were visiting?
Yes. Most of the time, yes. I mean, as I was reporting for Over the Seawall, I think I had been worried the whole time. I'm walking into people's lives, walking into their villages. This is true in Bangladesh and in Japan, and asking people to relive like the worst day of their life, which they probably have done many times before for previous journalists and or academics coming in, to research these things. And I was always really self-conscious about that and worried that what was the value in what I'm doing. But what I discovered was that people were more afraid of their stories being forgotten than they were of somebody coming in and asking them to relive it again. In Southwest Bangladesh, people are they depend on foreign aid and have for a long time. They still are living, below well below the poverty line, and they're lacking basic things that most Americans would do. We would not never live that way, we just can't even imagine it. And there are millions of people around the world living like this, and so no matter how many times the story is told and they're asked to to retell it, I think there's still a hope, a chance that's one time somebody's going to come and actually do something about it.
Yeah. Arizona is the last part of your book. Before we get to that, I'm just wondering, of all the places in the world that you could visit to highlight some of these maladaptations, Japan and Bangladesh, how did you come to choose those two places?
Well, like I said, as I was doing the early research for Over the Seawall, I came across the studies on maladaptation, the maladaptive seawalls in Japan. And that hadn't been my first choice of place to go because I didn't realize, because it's not a climate change issue. But the fact that it just told the story in such a concise way, and it really, for me, it helped me understand this big kind of wonky idea. So I decided that I wanted the readers to also get that. I traveled to Bangladesh the first time around 2019 with some researchers who were studying migration, climate migration there, and I had been walking along, and I'd heard stories about the embankments and how problematic they were. And I asked someone to say, "Where are these embankments?" And she pointed to our feet, the ground beneath us, and she said, "We're walking on them." And I realized I had been walking on these embankments the entire time. And so I realized being there that wow, this is really like maladaptation at a massive scale, and affecting so many people's lives over such a long period of time. So I knew that was a story that needed to be told.
We're talking with science journalist Stephen Robert Miller about his book, Over the Seawall: Tsunamis, Cyclones, Drought, and the Delusion of Controlling Nature. We'll talk more after a break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking with science journalist Stephen Robert Miller about his book, Over the Seawall: Tsunamis, Cyclones, Drought, and the Delusion of Controlling Nature. All right, Central Arizona is the third segment of the book, our third stop, if you will. And this is where you grew up, right? So you write about the Central Arizona Project, which brings water from the Colorado River into Arizona. Desert. Arizona's like desert, right?
Yes, it's a
Not a lot of
desert. Yeah.
water.
Not a lot of water in Arizona. Yeah, I grew up in Arizona. I was actually born in Pittsburgh, but I moved to Arizona as a kid, and spent most of my life there. I got my journalism degree at the University of Arizona. I met my wife there, and it took me a while, but I came to really love Arizona. I love the Sonoran Desert. It is a phenomenal place. But also while I was there, I always kind of had this strange sense in the back of my mind to think like, this is kind of weird. There's a lot of people, my family included, moving to this place in the middle of the desert where every day, those of us who are paying attention are hearing about the issue of something like water being a real concern. I mean, when people are saying that water is a real regular concern, that should raise some red flags. But if you look at what's happening in Arizona with this, the continued massive the sprawl and just the it was one of the fastest growing places in the country. It is every year. I feel like people are not recognizing those red flags. And so I wanted to explore that issue.
And it's interesting because I don't I've been through Arizona, don't know a lot about Arizona, but I can remember flying into Las Vegas, and as you're flying in and you just see all the brown, right? Because again, not a lot of water. But then when you get right into Las Vegas and you start to see the green, a lot of it's artificial turf in the yards, and there's a, again another place in the desert where we're bringing water in. So tell us a little bit more about this Central Arizona project.
Right. So the Central Arizona Project is a canal that carries water from the Colorado River on the border with California. And it takes it about 350 miles, much of them uphill from the river to Phoenix and then south down to just south of Tucson. The canal was built beginning in the 1960s and completed around 1985. And it was really a solution to the problem of obviously drought in the desert. What had happened the years previously is that farmers, especially in the middle of the country, had sucked the ground dry. I mean, to the point where the ground underneath their feet was collapsing, subsiding, sometimes like 12 feet deep, just plop, dropping. It became clear that Arizonans were not going to survive off groundwater or the surface water that was available from the local rivers, like the Gila and the Salt. And they were going to need another source of water. And what happened, right, was in the 1922, there was this Colorado River Compact. We just passed the centennial of that. And so there's been a lot of talk about around this. And that, right, was essentially the contract that determined how the seven Western states that depend on the Colorado River were going to divvy up its water. And I talk about that compact as kind of the base of this thing, the maladaptation that's happening in Arizona and the Southwest in general today, because what that contract did was commit the seven states and then eventually Mexico to taking a certain amount of water. It said you can take this much water out of the river. And when you say that to somebody in the desert, they're going to take every drop that they can get. And so Arizona was finding that, it had rights to a certain amount of water, but most of its people lived in the middle of the state, really far from the river. And so the question was, well, how are we going to get that water? And so they decided to build this canal, which at the time was the largest public works project in history.
So, talk about the reason you would want to be a farmer in the middle of the desert. What kinds of things are we growing?
lots of things. I mean, it's a winter lettuce capital of the world. Obviously, hay, cotton, alfalfa, cantaloupe, citrus. One of the state's earliest big products was citrus, and there's still tons of citrus plants all over. I mean, soybeans can grow there. All kinds of crops. It is one of the. I spent a lot of time talking with farmers. This, over the seawall. I tried to get out of the wonkiness and avoid too much of the academic and just talk to the people who are living these things. And so In Arizona, I spend most of my time with farmers, just particularly one young farmer who has recently learned that he is running out of water. He's getting cut off from the river. And the way he puts it, there should be nobody but farmers and ranchers in this state. He talks about, seven harvests. You can get seven harvests out of the ground in Arizona because there's so much sun. And while, other parts of the country, the Midwest, are plowed under in snow and frozen over, Arizona farmers are still growing. And so his argument is like, you can build houses and data centers anywhere, but there aren't many places in the country where you can grow like this because we have so much sun.
So many farmers are seeing water shortages, which of course impacts their farms. And like this farmer who's, without water, he has no farm, right? He has no crops. So how, first of all, how many farms are we talking about? Are there a lot of farms?
Yes, well, so the ones who are most directly affected by this are in the center of the state in an area called Pinal County, which is just between Phoenix and Tucson. They've been dependent on the Central Arizona Project, and therefore the Colorado River since the 80s. And there are hundreds of farms in this area.
Yeah. It's interesting that you start this section of the book with a guy who wants to build a surfing resort, and he thinks he will have plenty of water, and in fact says he would use less than the hay farm that the site where he wants his new venture. First, I saw that, went, wait, a surfing resort in Arizona? I imagine in the middle of the desert people would like something like that, but then I thought, could that be possible that he would use less water than the hay farm?
Mindy, I thought the same thing. When I came across that, I was pretty blown away. And so I went and I interviewed him and saw the project being built, and I just want to understand what his thinking was. And I get it. There's tons of people moving there, and he wants to provide an opportunity for some fun recreation and make some money off of it. It makes perfect sense. Growing hay takes a lot of water. It's one of the most water intensive crops that we grow in the desert. I mean, hay and cotton are two of the biggest crops grown in this part of a part of the state. And they're also two of the thirstiest. And so that's obviously a real problem. So there's this sense in Arizona that, and all over the West, really, here up in Colorado where I live now, that if we can buy out these farms, called buy and dry. Buy out the farm and take the water from it and apply that water to municipal and residential growth. And then you can continue to have cities growing in water-stressed areas because there's just so much water locked up in agriculture. And the truth of the matter is, right, that at least three quarters of the water used in the Colorado River Basin is used by agriculture. So it is by far the biggest user. And yeah, if you got rid of all the ag, people could continue to build giant cities for a very long time. But then, of course, who would grow anything?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, and I guess the surfing community thinks this is a great idea too, right?
Of course, and beachfront property in Arizona—that's what they was doing there. It really blew my mind.
Yeah, very funny. So we talk about false sense of security earlier in Japan with the seawalls. Do we have a bit of that here in an overconfidence in technology?
Yeah, I mean, that's my argument, and that's why I come to Arizona last. My thinking on this, I spend the first two-thirds of the book going to Japan and Bangladesh, and I came across examples like this all over the world that don't appear in the book. Some of them do, kind of in shorter bits. But if you're going to go around the world and tell everybody that they're making huge mistakes, then you got to be willing to hold the mirror to yourself, right? So I always knew I was going to come home and write about where I grew up, and write about Arizona. And my thinking on this is, the Central Arizona Project in particular. Is doing something similar to what the seawalls did in Japan, where that woman riding her bicycle along on the one side of the seawall while this wave is bearing down on her, and she has no idea because she can't see it. You go to Arizona and talk to just regular folks who are not following the news around climate change and the issues with the groundwater supply and the Colorado River supply. People there don't really know that there's a problem. And I think that's largely because this infrastructure has been built and they've depended on it. And they have so much confidence in, the Bureau of Reclamation's ability to protect them from drought and long-term shortages that they don't even think about it. They don't even know that there's this big wave, a drought, bearing down on them from the desert.
Yeah. And you think about, I'm going back to Las Vegas for a minute because, it's a city in the desert, right? And you have all the water and coming from the Hoover Dam. And then just recently, when we saw all the drought and how low the dam has gotten, I mean, it's,
That's right.
yeah, I mean, so we don't really know. We might have a drought one year and then we don't, but it seems like we're droughts are happening more and more, and we don't really know if that water's going to be there. This is the desert after all, right?
Yeah, we should, but I think that we should just depend on it not being there, because it is a desert after all, right? But we build this infrastructure, then you get complacent. You sort of think, well, there's going to be water. There has been since, you know, we built the dam and we built the canal, and you get complacent around that. The issue, of course, with the water getting so low behind the dam, right, is that eventually it will reach this point where it will no longer be able to be taken up and used to create energy, to create electricity. So one thing I mentioned in the book is it's not just the water issue. The water issue gets all of the press, all the attention, for very good reason, but there are a lot more threats bearing down on people living in the middle of the desert than just the water. I mean, just this last year, there's a record number of deaths in Maricopa County around Phoenix from extreme heat. I think it was in the 500s.
Yeah.
And that is getting worse and worse every year.
Yeah, watching the temperatures, you know, the weather forecast, it's as depressing as the news now, right? Where you look at there's always some weather disaster happening somewhere around the world.
That's true.
And yeah, it's crazy. So we've been talking about physical adaptations, but what about policies and laws?
Right. So with the Colorado Compact, the 1922 Compact, I think is probably the most egregious example of that, right? Because it locked the states in. It's one of the things about maladaptation is that in some cases it will pass the risk on to another group. In some cases it just increase greenhouse gas emissions. So something like a desalination plant can be considered maladaptive, or air conditioning is considered maladaptive, because as long as you're powering those things with fossil fuels, you are emitting greenhouse gases that are adding to the problem you're trying to avoid, right? And one of the other things, right, is this the lock-in. So the Colorado River Compact, some of these policies that we enact, lock us into a future where we have fewer and often worse decisions than we had before. And this became really important to me because over the course of writing this book, I found out that I was going to be a dad. My first son was born actually the week I was finishing up the copy edits on the manuscript. And so I really started thinking about, you know, the decisions that we're leaving our kids and the options that we're leaving our kids. And that's a real pervasive issue with maladaptation, is that you start building signing these contracts, building this infrastructure, and you limit the choices that future generations are going to have.
Yeah.
Another one that we're learning about now more and more, it's more in the news, right, is insurance. So I've written about crop insurance and how encourages farmers to stick with sometimes, you know, the wrong crops or thirsty crops in the desert, or are growing a marginal land because they're repeatedly paid for losses. And that disincentivizes them from adapting, from trying to grow new crops or putting money into other ideas. But, you know, that's something that you can't really depend on just the farmers to up and just change everything they're doing one day. They're depending on the market. They need to make a living, right? That's something that the government needs to do. The government needs to change some of these policies, like crop insurance and like the Colorado River Compact, and bring these policies up to a climate change era.
Are you optimistic at all that government will do that?
You know, it's funny. You write a book because I wrote most of this during the pandemic. And so I actually reported the Arizona section first, even though it comes last in the book, because I had such a difficult time getting into Japan and Bangladesh because of the COVID lockdowns. So by the time the book came out now, you know, Arizona has a new governor, Hobbs, and she is going, I mean, she is making, I think, a pretty concerted effort to make changes, real meaningful changes in the way that Arizona looks at its groundwater. I mean, just something as simple as bringing to light a report on the available groundwater in the Phoenix area that had been for years kind of kept under the radar. She very quickly in her term made it public. Mm-hmm. And little things like that, just to, you know, to change the thinking there, I think, and to call into question some of the previous policies around laws that govern water use in the desert. And I do think that, yeah, so I mean, the answer is yes, I am somewhat optimistic, because I'm seeing there are people out there in positions of power who make better decisions.
Mm. We don't know what the future holds, right? And we can sort of base things a little bit on what might have happened in the past, but how do we learn from some of these maladaptations and prevent some disasters in the future?
So everybody, when I talk about this book, asks me, what's the solution, Stephen? Tell us what we should do. You know, and I always say, I wrote a book about the problems with solutions. I'm really hesitant to just provide more solutions that are going to fall into the same trap that I'm calling out here. But I do think that, the reason I wrote about these things is because there's so much to be learned from them. I want people to read the book and to see how folks made these decisions in the past and recognize some of these mistakes. One thing that I learned in reporting over the seawall is that the best solutions come from the people who live in the places where the solutions are going to be implemented. They come from knowledge of the place. You can call that indigenous knowledge or whatever you want. But at the end of the day, people who do have lived there for a long time and have been on that in that landscape, know how to work with the land. And that's what we need to be doing, right? Is working with the land, not rather than trying to fight against it all the time.
Yeah. That's a really good point, but I wonder how often people listen to the people who live in whatever, especially someplace like Bangladesh, which, in these communities we're talking about, their voices often go unheard.
That's right. Well, Karuna, right? The woman we talked about, I mean, she was killed because she tried to speak up and say what her people needed. And in Japan, I over the seawall talks quite a bit about the folks there who have pushed back against the government's plans to build big walls because it goes against their livelihood, we have this expert complex. It's touchy now because you don't want to, we do need to trust science. We do need to trust the experts, but the experts and scientists also need to be willing to trust locals, and there needs to be a dialogue between the two groups.
In the introduction, you write, adaptation is not a solution, it's a practice over time. What is it that you hope people take away from the book?
I hope that they recognize that as they make these decisions, they think long term about how the decisions are going to affect future generations and leave open the possibility for change. The worst thing that we can do is to build concrete structures that are backed up by hardened laws and contracts that are immalleable, right? That we can't change as the situation changes because our baselines are going to change. There's innumerable uncertainties around climate change, and we need to give ourselves the space to adapt to them, to evolve with them, to react to them in real time, and not lock ourselves into a future where we have fewer and worse decisions than we had before.
You talked about the birth of your first son. You look at the future a bit differently now that you're a father. So how has that fatherhood changed your perspective on everything?
I used to be a lot more cynical. I still am a pretty cynical person, people tell me. Like I said, I wrote the Arizona section of Over the Seawall first. I think that's the angriest section of the book. When I reread that section now, I can tell there's an anger in the writing. When I get to Japan, which I actually wrote last, and that by that point I knew I was going to have a son, and even my tone, I think, in the writing becomes a little softer, and I'm looking more for the people who are coming up with ways to solve this thing and have better ideas, and I think it really made the put the focus for me on giving options to our kids, leaving them with a better situation than we've created for ourselves.
There's always some surprises as you're researching something like this, and I'm sure there are things you didn't include in the book. But what was the biggest surprise in as you were researching this book for you?
Oh man.
Lots of them.
There's so many. I mean, you spend that much time traveling the world and talking to so many fascinating people. But there's one story that did not make the book that I often wish I had put in there. Maybe I'll throw it in the paperback version or something. But I was in Japan at this elementary school, Okawa Elementary, which is kind of famous now among in the lore of the tsunami. It was a place where something like 78 of 104 students were killed when the wave came. The school was actually, I think, about 5 miles upriver from the coast. So people there thought they were relatively safe, but the wave pushed all the way up the river. At the time, the leaders, the school principal, urged everyone to the top of the school to the attic, which is what the official evacuation guidelines said to do. But a handful of teachers and students actually decided instead to go up and flee to a hill behind the school. And the ones who did that, who went against the rules, there's a big argument about this, but the ones who fled up the hill survived. And the ones who stayed behind and followed the official protocol were killed. The school is there, it's left there now. It's a relic. You can go visit it and see exactly as it is the day that the wave came. And it's really a really impactful thing. While I was there, I came across these two young girls who were on spring break. They were, I think, about 16 and like 12. And I asked them, what are you doing spending your spring break visiting these, you know, this really terrifying monument to death and poor decisions? And they said they had been spending their whole spring break visiting all sorts. They have all these relics off and down the coast from the wave, these memorials that are left standing. And that's what they were doing. They were spending their spring break visiting them. And the youngest girl said that she had heard about the wave, but didn't really know what to do when one came. And she wanted to understand what had happened so that she could try to grow up, that she could grow up and try to help avoid it happening again. And to me, that became kind of like a central focus of this book was, you know, like I was wondering, why am I writing a book about so much doom and gloom when people really just want to be told everything's going to be okay? And here was this young girl saying, no, like we need to know what happened. We need to face it full on. And that's the only way we're going to protect ourselves. And that to me was so impactful.
The book is Over the Seawall: Tsunamis, Cyclones, Drought, and the Delusion of Controlling Nature. We'll have a link with more information at our website, capeandislands.org. Stephen Robert Miller, thanks so much for joining us, and thanks for writing the book.
Thanks, Minnie. I appreciate it.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.